His title is An Affair of the Heart. Brother Tech.
Thank you, Brother Dennis. Good morning, brothers and sisters. It's lovely to be with you. In 1865, when John Wilkes Booth was escaping from the Washington Theater, having assassinated President Lincoln, he fell and broke his leg. It was a country doctor, Dr. Samuel Mudd, who later fixed his leg. When he realized what Booth had done, he reported it to the authorities. They arrested him. They charged him as being a co-conspirator, and in course of time, he was given life imprisonment. We have a saying back home which applies to people who have totally lost their reputation and have damaged their standing. We say, their name is mud. I don't know whether you have that saying here, because we are two nations separated by a common language. But if you have that expression, just imagine, if your name was mud, what chance have you really got of clearing your name? Well, as it happened, Samuel Mudd did clear his name. There was an outbreak of yellow fever. He was helpful in the prison where he was incarcerated. In course of time, he was pardoned and was allowed to return to his practice and his life. His name was Mudd. But even so, it was recoverable. And if you feel sorry for Dr. Samuel Mudd, think about Jeremiah. Jeremiah's name means exalted or elevated by God. And yet nowadays, if you use the expression, as perhaps again you do, when you say, don't be such a Jeremiah, you ever heard that expression? Don't be such a Jeremiah. It means don't look on the dark side of life. Don't be so gloomy. Don't be so miserable. Don't always see the things that are going to happen. There's even a dictionary definition back home in which Jeremiah is a person who always prophesies doom and gloom. Yet his name meant exalted and elevated by the Lord. Jeremiah himself, of course, recognized that he hadn't got a good message to convey. If you were to stop Jeremiah in the street around Jerusalem and say, excuse me, Jeremiah, what's the time? He would say, it is time to repent because the city, Jerusalem, is about to fall and you will go into captivity unless you hand yourself over to the Babylonians when your life will be spared. And you'd say, oh, thank you, Jeremiah, and move on to ask a passing policeman. Jeremiah recognized that his message was one of doom and gloom. Come and have a look at Jeremiah 20, which we'll be looking at during the course of the week. This was the occasion when Pasha, the son of Immer, the chief priest, had put Jeremiah in the stocks and later on had released him. Now, Pasha meant prosperity round about, and Jeremiah said to him, you might remember, your name will be Magor Mizabib, which meant terror on every side. And then he turned and spoke to God. And this was what he said there at verse 7 of Jeremiah 20. O Lord, thou hast deceived me, and I was deceived. Thou art stronger than I, and hast prevailed. I am in derision daily. Everyone mocketh me. For since I spake, I cried out, I cried violence and spoil, because the word of the Lord was made a reproach unto me and a derision daily. Then I said, I will not make mention of him, nor speak any more in his name. But his word was in mine heart as a burning fire, shut up in my bones, and I was weary with forbearing, and I could not stay. There was Jeremiah's dilemma. He knew that whenever he was to speak, he was to speak about violence and destruction, but he couldn't but speak. He was forced to declare and to declaim the word of the Lord. But do you notice something unusual about that particular response? It was Skinner in an interesting little book called Prophecy and Religion about the book of Jeremiah who pointed out that of all the various prophets, Jeremiah is the first interactive prophet. Think about Isaiah and ask yourself for a moment, What does Isaiah say back to God? And the answer appears to be, "Here am I, send me." And after that, he declaims what God has told him, and wonderfully so. But Jeremiah isn't that sort of a prophet. Jeremiah is a prophet who interacts with God, who hears what God has to say, and then who constantly is saying, "But this doesn't sound fair, and this isn't right, and I don't like saying this sort of thing." He's that sort of a prophet. And yet he prophesied at some remarkable times. He prophesied during the time of King Josiah. And you know about Josiah. Josiah was a good king. I've always been struck by the fact that when the temple authorities came to tell the king that they had found something, what they said, and it sounds so like an ecclesial business meeting, they said, "The work is going well, O king. The money is okay, and we're being able to fund it all right. Oh, by the way, we found an old scroll in the temple." That's so often how we look at life, isn't it? We look at the administrative things, the maintenance of the building, the way things are going, and then we say, "And here's the book of the law." And you remember the reaction of Josiah? Josiah rent his clothes, read what was in the scroll, almost certainly the scroll of the prophecy of Isaiah, and as a result began that huge process of reform. And Jeremiah seems to have been caught up in that process. If you come for a moment to Jeremiah 15, you'll notice Jeremiah saying there at verse 16 of Jeremiah 15, "Thy words were found, and I did eat them. And thy word was unto me the joy and rejoicing of mine heart. For I am called by thy name, O Lord God of hosts. I sat not in the assembly of the mockers, nor rejoiced. I sat alone because of thy hand, but thou hast filled me with indignation." There was Jeremiah, seemingly, being able to have access to the scroll of Deuteronomy that appears to have been lost for a long period of time and now is found. And when he reads it and absorbs it, it fills his heart with joy. And then he realizes, sadly, how far Israel were from being able to live up to the standards of that law. How did he react then when Josiah began the process of reformation? Well, it's an intriguing thing to notice that, in fact, he was careful and cautious about his response. Come and have a look for a moment at the early chapters of Jeremiah. Notice how Jeremiah reacts to the things that are being done. He looks at all the reformation that appears to be taking place outwardly. There at verse 6, for example, of Jeremiah 3, "The Lord said also unto me, in the days of Josiah the king, in the days of Josiah the king, hast thou seen that which backsliding Israel hath done? She has gone up upon every high mountain and under every green tree, and there hath played the harlot. And I said after she had done all these things, Turn thou unto me, but she returned not, and her treacherous sister Judah saw it. And I saw when, for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel had committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorce, yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. And it came to pass through the lightness of her whoredom that she defiled the land and committed adultery with stones and with stocks. And yet for all this, her treacherous sister Judah hath not turned unto me with her whole heart, but feignedly, saith the Lord." Do you notice there that Jeremiah's take on Josiah's reformation, which should strike a note with all of us, is that whilst outwardly there was a lot going on, whilst the process of reform was being driven by an earnest and good king, yet actually most of the people were just pretending. They weren't really committed with all their hearts. They weren't engaged in the process, which meant, of course, that when Josiah fell, The Reformation fell too, and the hearts of Israel returned from where they had been. And yet, you know, the very book that had impelled the king to go upon that process of reform was a book that pleaded with Israel, pleaded with them to turn to God with all their hearts and with all their minds. I don't know if you've noticed, but if you've ever looked for the pattern of the word love, the Hebrew word aheb, in the Pentateuch, then it occurs very infrequently in the early books. It occurs just 6 times in the book of Exodus, comes twice in Leviticus, both of them in Leviticus chapter 19, remember, where the second great commandment was lodged, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. It comes just twice in the book of Numbers, and again in Numbers chapter 14, as we might expect, the very chapter that contains the words, as truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with my glory. But in the book of Deuteronomy, it occurs 28 times. Deuteronomy is much more than a retelling of the law. Deuteronomy is an interpretation of the law. What Moses was doing as he distilled his 120 years of experience and expounded to Israel, what he was doing was to tell them how they could keep the law. They would never keep it out of mere obedience. They had to love the Lord their God. Come have a look at Deuteronomy 6. You know it well, but for the Jews, of course, this was the Shema. This was the very first set of words that they would be taught to read when they were infants. It was meant to be the prayer that they uttered every day. For an Orthodox, a conservative, and a keeping Jew, it should be the very last words that he or she ever uttered. And here they are. Deuteronomy chapter 6, and there at verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. And thou shalt write them upon the posts of thy house and on thy gates. Well, you see it nowadays, don't you? You see people wearing their phylacteries. You see people with their little statements on the doorpost of their house, if they happen to be Jewish occupants of a condominium or a flat. You can see it outwardly, but the crucial thing was that if they loved the Lord their God, the word of God should be written on their hearts. And only love can do that. And later on in Deuteronomy 7, God says that the only reason why he had chosen Israel was because he loved them. Remember verse 7? The Lord did not set his love upon you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any people, for ye were the fewest of all people, but because the Lord loved you, and because he would keep the oath which he had sworn unto your fathers, hath the Lord brought you out with a mighty hand, and redeemed you out of the house of bondmen, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know therefore that the Lord thy God, he is God, the faithful God, which keepeth covenant and mercy with them that love him, and keep his commandments to 1,000 generations. You see what Moses is doing as he interprets and explains how the law could be kept? He is saying, you will only ever keep the law of God if you love him so much that you cannot bear not to do what he asks of you. Well, it's a remarkable interpretation. It's Moses explaining how Israel were to live by faith and to live by love. You know, once we understand that, brothers and sisters, once we appreciate that the Bible is a love story, then we recognize that wherever we turn, this is the outpouring of a love that is capable of controlling us. And love is a remarkable thing. I remember once when my elder son, Tim, got two sons, Tim and James. My elder son, Tim, was going through his awkward phase, as pretty well everybody does at one stage or another. I remember going through it myself. When he was going through his awkward stage, we could do nothing with him, absolutely nothing with him. He lived his own little life in our house, and as such, we were just unable to get in there. But then he found a lady with whom he fell in love, and she could control him absolutely. She had only to say she was thinking of going to dinner with somebody else, and suddenly he was a transformed individual. You see, brothers and sisters, love can change us too. And that's why God is reaching out to us in his word, pleading with us, appealing to us. George Matheson was a man who had been engaged to a fiancée, but he went to the doctor one day, and the doctor diagnosed that he had an incurable problem and that he was going to be blind. And she couldn't hack it, and so she broke off the engagement. And he did go blind, absolutely blind. He was totally dependent for the next 20 years upon his sister. And then his sister got married, and he was left entirely by himself. And in the immediate aftermath of his sister's marriage, he wrote a hymn that we don't sing, but you probably know it. It contains the words, "O love that will not let me go, I rest my weary soul in thee. I give thee back the life I owe, that in thine ocean depths its flow may richer, fuller be." You see, brothers and sisters, we've come to this Bible school and to this table of the Lord because the love of God has reached out to each one of us, and we have come to realize and to recognize that this is a love that will not let us go. A love that if we properly pursue it and allow it to take over our lives, is a love that will control us, contain us, keep us, lead us, and bring us at last to the feet of the Lord whom we love. You know, back in Jeremiah was appealing with Israel. Can I take you to Jeremiah chapter 2 and look at it for a moment in terms of God pleading like a lover to those who have left him and gone astray, and see it in that particular way. "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me," Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 1, "saying, Go and cry in the ears of Jerusalem, saying, Thus saith the Lord." Now notice, this is a lover pleading with his beloved. "I remember thee, the kindness of thy youth, the love of thine espousals, and thou wentest after me in the wilderness, in a land that was not sown. Israel was holiness unto the Lord, and the first fruits of his increase. All by him shall offend, evil shall come upon them, saith the Lord. Hear ye the word of the Lord, O house of Jacob, and all the families of the house of Israel. Thus saith the Lord, What iniquity have your fathers found in me, that they are gone far from me, and have walked after vanity, and have become vain? Neither said they, Where is the Lord that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, that led us through the wilderness, through a land of deserts and of pits, through a land of drought and of the shadow of death, through a land that no man passed through, and where no man dwelt? And I brought you into a plentiful country, to eat the fruit thereof and the goodness thereof. But when ye entered, ye defiled my land and made mine heritage an abomination. The priest said not, Where is the Lord? And they that handle the law knew me not. The pastors also transgressed against me, and the prophets prophesied by Baal and walked after things that do not profit. Wherefore, I will yet plead with you, saith the Lord, and with your children's children will I plead. It's remarkably intense, isn't it? This is the love of God, pleading with his people, begging them to think about the things that he has done, remonstrating with them and asking them, what wrong has he ever done them? Hasn't he done for them the best? Didn't he deliver them? Didn't he save them? Didn't he settle them in the land as he had promised? Being a faithful God. And then he asks, well, look at verse 32. Can a maid forget her ornaments? Or a bride her attire? Notice God saw himself there as married to a people. Yet my people have forgotten me days without number. Well, that's the sadness of it, brothers and sisters. And we're looking back at thousands of years of history, of course. But see how it touches the heart. God makes exactly the same appeal to each of us. What more could he have done than that which he has done in the giving of his son? And did you notice Israel's problem? Well, it was there in our reading for today in Jeremiah chapter 17. Israel were so hard-hearted that the only way that you could make an impression upon them was with the point of a diamond, was with a metal tool that would engrave some mark upon their heart. And they were untouchable and untouched by the love of God. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I, the Lord. You see, brothers and sisters, all things are naked and open before the eyes of him with whom we have to do. And God looks into all of our hearts now at this feast of love and knows us through and through and pleads with us still that we might be his people, touched in the heart. Jeremiah was commanded to go to the potter's house, we'll be reading about it tomorrow, and to see the potter shaping and forming the clay upon the wheel. And if it had marred, he could throw it again, and he could start and reshape. And for as long as God is able to reshape us and mold us and change us to be the people that he wants us to be, so far, so good. But a chapter on, Jeremiah is told to go to the potter's house again, and this time to buy some pots, and to go with the elders of Jerusalem. And now those pots were fired and hard. They were certain and sure about their substance. They were unchangeable. And Jeremiah was told to smash them and destroy them, for now God could do nothing more with them. Well, we come to a place where God is working with us, shaping us, moving us, changing us, wanting us to be the very people for his own possession that will be his prized treasure when the king comes. It's love that brought us to this Bible school. Love that has brought us to the table of the Lord. And it was love that brought the two Marys to the tomb early that morning. Our New Testament picks up that, and we're nearly finished, but let's think about their love story for a moment. In our New Testament reading, what we find is that when Mary and Mary, the wife of Cleopas, come to the empty tomb, they see an angel. And the angel asks them, or tells them there at verse 5, "Fear ye not, for I know that ye seek Jesus, which was crucified. He is not here, for he is risen, as he said." And then do you notice what the angel says? "Come see the place where the Lord lay. Superior to the angels, notice. Now the Lord of the angels, come see the place where the Lord lay. And it was love that brought Mary back to that very place, and looking in, she saw not one angel this time, but two, one sitting at the head and the other sitting at the feet of where the Lord had laid. And it's John, remember, who picks up that detailed record. For now, the angels speak again. Mary stood without at the sepulchre weeping, and as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the sepulchre. It was like the mercy seat with the cherubim above the mercy seat, for there were two angels in white sitting, the one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain. And they said unto her, Woman, why weepest thou? Whom seekest thou? She saith unto them, Because they have taken away my Lord, and I knew not where they have laid him. When she had said that, she turned around and thought the gardener was behind her. And she said, Sir, if thou hast borne him hence, tell me where thou hast laid him, and I will take him away. Now there's love for you. His body would have been stiff with rigor mortis. It would have been an impossible burden for a woman to have borne, but if only she knew where the body was to be found, she would have lifted him up, and she would have brought him back to tend him and to care for him. And he said to her, Mary. And she said, Rabboni. This was a love that would not let her go. And that was the very essence of the writer in the Song of Songs, who dreamt one night, remember, that she had lost everything that she really cared about. And then in her dream, she found him. And the record says, she would not let him go. Well, brothers and sisters, at this feast of love, at this affair of the heart, here is the love of God that reaches out to each of us, that we might rekindle our love and show in the way that we live and in the things that we do that we love him too.